Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this week we are going to be talking to Phil Hammond, aka MD, who is Private Eye's medical correspondent, about COVID, about how we have been responding to it so far, and what remains to be done about it. We'll also be talking to Jane McKenzie about Stonehenge, the ancient and extremely important site, and about the range of unpalatable options there are for actually trying to move around anywhere near Stonehenge, which is unfortunate because the main road between the southwest and southeast of England goes basically past it. There is going to be a solution constructed or dug any millennium now, and it only remains to find out what it's actually going to be. That's coming up a bit later, but firstly, once again, COVID. Phil Hammond has just published a book called Dr. Hammond's COVID Casebook, and it's very eye-related because it consists of his columns published in the Eye between the beginning of the pandemic and now. It's a fascinating book. It's full of interesting stuff, which you may have been reading in the magazine as it's gone along, and now it's all collected in one place together. So I started off my conversation with Phil by congratulating him. Surely the fact that he's publishing a book now means it's all over, done and dusted. Well done to him and the rest of the NHS on a pandemic well handled and now in its mission accomplished phase.
If only. Well, the Euros is, the Olympics is, the British Lions tour is, not sure the pandemic is.
Okay.
Who knows? It's sort of suggesting at the moment that the vaccines are working brilliantly, and that's been the real success story of all of this, is that the vaccine works and loads of people have had them. And that seems to be, as well as stopping people going to hospital and dying, it's also stopping transmission. So that's a really good news story, but we sort of were lulled into a false sense of security last year, thinking the summer would be fine, and then it really took off again over the autumn. I don't think it's going to be as bad, but there could be significant issues, particularly if another variant arrives. So I think cautious optimism, be cautious indoors and go wild outdoors and don't be a wazzock, is my three top tips.
That's a very good prescription.
Obviously get double jabbed, because I think that makes a huge difference.
I think a lot of people will be thinking, well, if so many people are double jabbed and so many other people have already had it, is there really much to fear in the autumn? But you're saying that the variants thing is the great unknown.
And also how long the vaccines last for. I mean, it's really difficult, isn't it? Should we, with our excess vaccines now, be giving them to countries that have only vaccinated a few percent of their population? Should we be giving it to our children? Should we be doing boosters to people? We just don't know what the best bang for our buck is and where to do the vaccines. But we don't know how long the vaccines will last for. So it's possible that the most vulnerable people who had their vaccines back in December may find that the protection starts wearing off before the autumn booster is given, and we may get another surge of elderly patients with COVID. So there are some unknowns, but there always will be unknowns. It's a new virus. It's a new pandemic. You can't predict viral behaviour, and you can't really predict human behaviour. And you can try and bribe people to have their vaccines with, you know, creamy donut vouchers or whatever, but you can't really predict how it's going to turn out.
One thing that's really interesting in your latest column of the Eye is about the UK government strategy and how it might differ from other countries' strategies and whether or not it's making a particularly good reputation for the UK overseas in terms of how we're dealing with that.
Yeah, it was interesting that we've sort of come up with this plan. I heard the term hybrid immunity that I've latched onto, this idea that we offer vaccines to all adults and we hope most of them will be double jabbed, but then we're more relaxed about it spreading in children because it appears to be much less serious. However, if you let it spread in large numbers on a delta wave to lots of children, you will get kids admitted to hospital with this and you will get long COVID, and also they will spread it to other people. But we've sort of said maybe we can inch towards herd immunity with a combination of natural spread amongst the least at risk, the children, and double vaccination for the adults. The World Health Organization doesn't like that because they're saying, well, look, you know, you gave us the Kent variant, now known as the Alpha variant, and then transported that all over the world. It caused a huge amount of misery. You then imported the Delta variant from India in vast numbers and then exported it again. And if you keep doing that and don't try to control it, then other countries will come a cropper because you'll be spreading it around the world. So that's why they're not very keen on our experiment. But in terms of the UK's own figures, Sajid Javid, the new health secretary, sort of predicted there might be up to 100,000 infections a day. Well, as well below that. He said there might be 100 or 200 deaths a day. Well, we're below that average. And the significant business in hospitals, but not enough to bring the service to its knees. So they're sort of saying, you've got to live with this. There will be some deaths. There will be some disease. But we've got to open up society, allow people to go to music festivals, etc. Enjoy the summer. But there could still be a little unpleasant surprise in the autumn and winter.
And the drop that you were talking about, the drop in daily infection rates, is an interesting one because, again, it gets to the heart of whether all of these figures are accurate.
It is really interesting. I mean, what do positive cases mean? Well, it means people who've tested positive. So first they've got to get a test. And initially we had a very narrow restriction of symptoms that would get you a PCR test, and then we widened it slightly. But it could be that people with the Delta variant, particularly if they've been vaccinated, if they're picking up infection despite vaccination, it may be they have a broader range of symptoms. They aren't as unwell. They maybe have coughs and allergic-type symptoms. So it's possible that a lot of people are going under the radar. It's also possible because people don't want to be pinged if they only have minor symptoms or no symptoms, that they're turning off their app. They're not coughing up their contacts. It's possible that, you know, people are just refusing to be tested now because they want to go about their summer holidays and their jobs. But it's also likely that we had a big surge during the Euros where lots of young men got together in pubs, and that's over now. So we had a big dip then. And it's interesting, in Scotland, where they were out of the Euros earlier and schools broke up earlier, their demise in cases happened sooner. So the Euro effect could have been that, you know, we had a bit of all together in the pub and spread a bit then. But now people haven't really ripped the pants off Freedom Day, to copy a term from Jonathan Van Tam. They're actually taking it quite seriously. People are still wearing masks indoors, quite a few of them. I went to a music festival. I had supposedly showed my vaccine passport at a sort of cursory glance, but I danced down in the mosh pit with lots of young people outdoors because I think outdoors is actually pretty safe, and kept my app on and haven't had any symptoms, haven't tested positive, haven't been pinged. So I think this message about going wild outdoors but still being sensible in the crowded indoors, particularly on public transport and particularly where there's no ventilation, is still the message. And it's interesting, the government's now changed its plans. It's now saying we actually are going to vaccinate 16 and 17-year-olds, and we may vaccinate 12 to 15-year-olds, as other countries have been doing, having previously, in fact, only 2 weeks ago, said that the risks were worse than the benefits. They've now changed their mind on which is a little bit confusing for people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fine margin because generally, COVID is less severe in young people, we think, although we don't know about long COVID. And there's a risk, it's a very small risk of pericarditis and myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart and the membrane around the heart, which is pretty rare but could happen. But in children, you really want to avoid it if you can. And the JCVI, which makes the decision about whether to vaccinate, has sort of been, you know, is it this, is it that, waiting for the data to arrive from other countries. Many European countries in America have already vaccinated lots of children. And the data seems to now show it is actually pretty safe in children too. So at very least, we should offer it to children, and then older children and adults can decide for themselves whether they want it. And I think many will accept it, because what they don't want COVID, but they don't want to be sent home in bubbles when the term opens again. And, you know, it's likely that people who are double vaccinated may not have to do that.
Do you think there is a reason why, some people aside, the UK hasn't really experienced the same level of vaccine disagreement over whether the vaccines do any good or not, as opposed to other countries such as the USA?
I mean, vaccine scares tend to be quite culture-specific, and different countries have different scares over different vaccines. I mean, I think we have got it right. I think also because our pre-vaccine management was pretty poor, and just about everyone knew people had been affected by this, and they saw the relentless pictures of crowded hospitals, intensive care units. I mean, they realised this was something worth getting vaccinated for. And I think there was real pride, actually, in the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. So when other countries were dissing it, saying, oh, it didn't work in older people or it was second rate or whatever, I think we felt proud of the fact that British volunteers and British scientists had largely come up with this vaccine and we wanted to have it. And actually, that's turned out to be a good call. The countries that delayed giving the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine for unwarranted smears and scares, probably, you know, there were thousands of avoidable deaths in those countries when they could have had it earlier. And I, as a, you know, I'm half Australian, and Australia had a good policy to start with, but didn't order enough vaccines. And then they fell for the Oxford AstraZeneca isn't as good a vaccine and wouldn't have it. And now, because of their zero COVID policy, they're almost in perpetual lockdown. So I think all countries' responses have been individual. You know, there wasn't a global World Health Organization coordinated response. Countries were pretty much left alone. And so following the science also meant following the culture and politics of individual countries. And we've all handled it a bit differently. And I think when the final public inquiry is done, we'll say, actually, there were little bits of policy in every country that we could have muddled together to come up with a perfect plan for next time. So I doubt any one country did brilliantly. I think you'll find really good examples of pandemic management in lots of different countries that we can combine as a sort of a best of template to follow next time.
Are there other broad lessons that can be specifically adapted to British healthcare from around the world?
Well, it's like your teachers used to say to you that if you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. Because ever since the original SARS in 2003 and MERS and other pandemics, Ebola and Zika virus, etc., every country had a pandemic plan. But our pandemic plan basically said we can't cope if there's a pandemic. we're just going to have to take it on the chin. I mean, that was our pandemic plan. We were in the middle of austerity and we decided not to invest in extra testing facilities or extra PPE. So our plan was, geez, we really are doomed. And it's interesting now, if you go retrospectively and look at the expert notes, why did we adopt this rather strange policy at the beginning, where we flirted dangerously with herd immunity before we realized how many people would die? It was basically the advice was, we're doomed. It was like the old Fraser from Dad's Army. And we were particularly doomed, not just because we hadn't prepared, but it became apparent that this virus could spread without symptoms. It had a long incubation period, which meant even people who got symptoms could be spreading it asymptomatically for many days. And then we found out it didn't just spread close range in droplets. It could hang around in the bloody air. So if you had a poorly ventilated student accommodation, it could take out all the students very quickly. It's an absolute bugger to stop. And people, when they realized this was happening, they thought, do you know what? We can't really stop it. We might be able to damp the wave a bit by social distancing. And then when they realized how big the wave would be, we decided on lockdown. But lockdown didn't really appear in the official notes for SAGE until about 6 days before it happened. But there's no evidence base for it. In a new pandemic, there isn't nice guidance on lockdowns because we haven't had them before. So following the science is fine when you know what the science is. We know what the science of heart attacks is, and we hope to manage it right first time every time. But in a new pandemic, there is no science. So you have to create the science and do the studies and then figure out what to do. So we weren't well prepared in that for a fairly rich nation, we're a bit parsimonious in the way that we fund our public services, particularly health and social care. So we have brilliant public health experts, but we don't have enough people on the ground to do the test, trace, isolate, support. And even then, we outsourced it to the private sector. So that clearly seemed to be a bit of a mistake. So countries who got a hold of it already had pretty well-resourced public health programs, such as in Germany and some Scandinavian countries. But it's interesting. I mean, everyone talks about Sweden. At the end of the day, when it's all said and done, it'll be really interesting to look at Sweden's figures, who didn't really do lockdowns. But lots of European countries have caught up with us on vaccination to see, at the end of the day, deaths and economic damage-wise, how much difference there is. Because the doomsters at the beginning are saying, pretty much whatever you do, it's all going to be roughly the same in comparable countries. And it might be over a course of a number of years. So we won't really know until it's all over. But I fear we probably should have been faster onto it. But, you know, even the World Health Organization were telling us that we shouldn't be using masks and we shouldn't be doing border controls. And the mask thing is interesting. I mean, one of the reasons we said don't use masks at the beginning is we didn't have enough of them for NHS staff. So we didn't want everyone using them. But actually, you know, there has been vaccine denial of people storming the wrong BBC building that hadn't been used for 10 years, made me smile. But actually, vaccine acceptance has been pretty good. I don't mind the protest particularly. And we've sort of been good at policing some of the anti-vax messages. I don't really like stories of, I mean, with people's consent, fair enough. So if your bodybuilding brother who climbed up Ben Nevis 3 days ago suddenly dies from COVID and he's only 40-something, I don't really like these things paraded as media stories and then people piling in and saying stupid anti-vaxxers. You know, people making a choice about what to put in their bodies and it should be voluntary. And, you know, some of the way that the news has spun against people who haven't had vaccines and then died, I haven't particularly liked watching. You know, we should support people and try and persuade them, but you can't force them. And we've done that pretty well. I'm still staggered at the number of people who are double vaccinated in this country. And young people, I think, partly because they think they won't be able to travel on holiday, go into nightclubs, are sort of being nudged in that direction. And I think we will end up with pretty good vaccine coverage, and that will be our saving grace.
That feels like a, as we said earlier, one of the ways the country has done pretty well. There is a perception, I think, that some countries have got through more or less all right simply because they have much more experience. Countries in East Asia, which had experience of dealing with things like SARS, so their preparation was much better. They locked down very fiercely as soon as they had a small cluster of cases, you know, and did specific lockdowns as opposed to a general national thing. And that those countries have kind of been all right for a lot of the last 18 months and haven't been experiencing the kind of permanent trudge or the semi-permanent trudge that places like the UK have had. Is that a fair perception, or is that a bit of a grass is greener thing?
Well, I think it's now changing a bit, because as the virus evolves, it generally, not always, it generally becomes fitter, and that means the Delta variant spreads far more quickly, and because of that, it causes far more damage. So all those countries that protected themselves through border controls and early lockdowns and stricter social measures, while the people are unvaccinated there, if they haven't had the same access to vaccines, they remain very vulnerable. So they're finding now, as I say, in Australia, in China now, they've got quite significant outbreaks in other countries, even countries that managed it first time round. The virus isn't going anywhere, and until they top it with good vaccination programs, they may get waves. And also people get bored after a while, and they say, OK, I was happy to give up 18 months or 2 years of my life to COVID with these strict restrictions, but I'm not so keen now. And we saw that with Germany and other European countries that did better than Britain in the first wave. Become the second wave, people getting a bit of COVID fatigue and COVID habituation, and they wanted to go to Christmas markets and they wanted to socialise, and that's what humans do. So I think we will look at it in who did best management pre-vaccine and who did best management post-vaccine. And the big challenge for us now, I think, is getting the vaccines where they're needed most.
Well, if we can just turn to the book that I mentioned earlier now, Dr. Hammond's COVID Casebook. One of the things about this book is that it's columns, meaning that you are reacting to things as they happen. It's not written from the perspective of a year and a half later. You're having to write this every fortnight.
Yeah,
and that's how the book is.
It's written and published in real time, so you can't really correct your errors too much. A little bit of editing went in for space reasons, but generally this is how I reported on as it happened, which I think makes it quite useful, although not always correct. And I think the lessons I learned, a number of lessons, the one is there's no single one expert you can listen to. Following the science is a myth, in a sense, in that even now you have fierce debates amongst scientists, professors at esteemed universities all going on. I mean, that's what's interesting about the science, is that it's about forming a hypothesis and testing it, and we only know when we do more science. So we really do need to do more studies on masks and non-pharmacological interventions. You know, the reason we know vaccines are so safe and effective, we've spent an absolute fortune testing them properly, and yet we don't do the same with other measures. I'm quite happy to be corrected by letters in the letters page, and that's what I like about the eye. It's almost like a thing of continuous improvement because the readers are so bright along the way that mistakes I've made in the columns have been corrected. So,
were you tempted to include those letters in
I was,
the
and the,
book?
The original one did. In fact, the original one went right to the back at the very beginning when I didn't think there would be a pandemic because I thought it would be like SARS in 2003. And then all of a sudden, you know, we reduced the genome in early January and we could start tests and we could start vaccines. And I was an optimist at the beginning. But I admitted that. And I think that's important that you, you know, that's that old saying about if science is all about making mistakes. If you're not making mistakes or owning up to the mistakes, you're not doing science properly. So we should be more relaxed about admitting our errors, as should politicians. I think they'd have got themselves into a much better position if they hadn't said with such certainty that we did everything we meaningfully could to have prevented the deaths and things. Were obviously nonsense. We didn't protect the NHS. We didn't stay ahead of the curve. You should just put your hand up and say, actually, there were things we could significantly improve on and probably could have done better with information we knew at the time. And then people would say, oh, these politicians understand science. So the book goes from my first long column to the end of Matt Hancock, which seemed like a good place to dip out. I have roared with laughter, and we shouldn't really laugh at things like that. But it is odd, isn't it, that that's the reason he resigned, not our high COVID deaths or failure to protect care homes.
You mentioned earlier on in this recording the prospect of the inevitable enormous public inquiry. Do you think that will happen?
What's interesting is a lot hinges on the statisticians. My big involvement in a public inquiry was the Bristol Heart Inquiry. So I started writing for Private Eye in 1992, and the first story I broke pretty much was to say that far too many babies were dying after complex heart surgery in Bristol. It took 7 years then to get a public inquiry, and it took that public inquiry 3 years to statistically analyse the deaths in one single hospital unit. So how many of these babies might have survived had they gone to equivalent units around the country? Have they not gone to Bristol? Have they gone to Southampton or Oxford? Incredibly complex, came up with the idea of excess deaths. It took him 3 years. David Spiegelhalter, who was the lead statistician, has said he wouldn't do another public inquiry again because it was so draining. Imagine the statistical complexity of a pandemic where you're trying to come up with an idea of how many lives we might have saved with our lockdowns and our pandemic lap management, and how many lives we might have saved if we'd gone earlier to lockdown and maybe come out earlier, and what are the cost of that is. I mean, that is unbelievably complicated, and I can't see how it would take anything less than 5 years. And it will be couched in quite statistical terms with lots of maybes and not much certainty. And I guess grief will be disseminated at lots of different levels, so it won't all be Boris Johnson's fault. They'll say, well, there are things we could have done well in different levels, including the NHS. You know, we sort of protected it, but there were lots of maybe cancer and heart disease patients we could have served better during the pandemic. So, yeah, I think there will be lessons to learn, but it's possible the next pandemic will arrive before we've reported on this one. I mean, that's the danger, is it takes so bloody long that flu is upon us and we have to think again. And I guess that's the other lesson, is that our pandemic plan was largely based around flu. And coronavirus behaved in a different way. And if we then go coronavirus and the next pandemic is flu, we have to be flexible. There has to be a plan B. You should be able to do U-turns and admit them in real time. That flexibility, I think, is really, really important.
Are there any other features of the book that you think are especially important that we should talk about before we go today?
Yes, it's got cartoons in it.
Oh, great.
I can guarantee you won't get that in the public inquiry report. So, you know, for me, as a comedian and a journalist and a broadcaster and a doctor, private eye has always been the way my brain works, I guess. Well, I have a really complex global problem. I love the combination of serious journalism and cartoons and satire. And so I was really pleased to have some great cartoons in the book. And they just, sometimes a cartoon is worth 1,000 words. They just absolutely up Schitt Creek cartoons. And the lovely one on the front that Zach did of chess, NHS chess. Of the virus and the chess pieces. And I'd also like to do a huge shout out to Tristan Davis. So Tristan edits and copy edits my columns and always does, and it's fabulous. And he was charged with making sense of all the stuff that we sent to him and turning it into a book. And he's done a beautiful job. And being the eye, we don't really praise people, so it doesn't come out. I should have said thank you, Tristan Davis, at the beginning, and I didn't. So I'm saying it now.
Well, we'll cut this bit out. That's
all right.
He knows
how fabulous he is, and he really went above and beyond with my columns and with the book throughout the pandemic. So thank you, Tris.
And thanks to Phil Hammond there too. Now to Stonehenge. This week's edition of the magazine contains a story all about Stonehenge and the latest judicial ruling on what is going to be done with it. Rather, not what is going to be done with the stones themselves, which obviously are going to be left as they are, hopefully in perpetuity, but with the human infrastructure around it. There is a road that passes really nearby, and for many years, the idea of a tunnel has been mooted to get the road out of the way of the Stonehenge and leave the landscape well preserved. Unfortunately, when you're digging underground near an enormous World Heritage Site of ancient and powerful significance, there is always going to be a complication or two along the way. Jane McKenzie has been covering these complications in Private Eye, and here she is with a brief guide to the recent history of Stonehenge, if not the origins. Here's Jane.
Since it came into public ownership in 1918, Stonehenge has been a bit of a problem for its owners in terms of how to get past it and how to let people look at it without causing harm to it. So there's a whole lot of problems, but certainly how to get past it is a significant one, because the road that connects the southeast and the southwest, the A303, following a sort of ancient route, passes very close to it. And the combination of the road narrows from a dual carriageway just before it, if you're going from the east to the west, and also everybody wants to have a quick look at the stones as they pass. So the road all slows down tremendously there. So there's sort of permanent traffic jam, certainly in the summer, through the middle of the World Heritage Site.
It's unbelievable. I've driven along this road 4 times this year, every single time. You don't need to look out for the stones because you know you're approaching the stones by the fact that you're going at 4 miles an hour for the next half an hour.
Creeping past that, which certainly gives everybody a good opportunity to have a peep, but isn't ideal for sort of the Southwest's economy or people who have to travel past regularly.
This one road is substantially slowing down economic activity in a quarter of the country. So, okay, what are we going to do about this? The proposal is to build, or rather dig, a tunnel that goes beneath and around, will stop people driving past from having a look at it, which is a shame, but might actually sort out the situation.
Yes, so over the many decades this has been thought about, various options have been considered. Well, you can't sort of reroute around to the north, or it's certainly a problem too, because the Ministry of Defence are there on Salisbury Plain blowing things up. So it's not ideal for a road to go through the middle of their ranges.
Okay. South it is then.
So,
great.
Yeah. So the idea of a tunnel has been sort of on the cards for quite a long time. The first piece I could find in Private Eye in the Nooks column is discussing it in terms of the comparative cost to making a bid to host the Olympics. So that's prior to the 2012 Olympics, but also prior to the bid. That's when we're talking about the comparative cost of building a tunnel there. Now, the current estimated cost of the tunnel that Highways England want to build is $1.7 billion, which is a lot more than the cost would have been back when it was first being talked about, but that's how inflation goes.
Yeah.
But that planned tunnel would bring the western end of the tunnel out, still within the World Heritage Site. So this is the equivalent of building the Channel Tunnel, but stopping too soon and coming out in the sea.
Okay. That is a very arresting image to describe why it doesn't quite work.
Mm.
But surely, Jane, if you're going to build a tunnel, it's going to have to go underground, I guess, at some point. I mean, surely wherever you build it, unless you start it 10 miles away and you go 200 metres down where there's no possible risk. I guess what we're talking about is the risk of bumping into artifacts, ancient artifacts, which haven't been dug up yet, but could be at some future date.
That's
right. Is that the problem?
That's right. And of course, sort of the whole of England, or the whole of the UK, is covered in possible archaeology, which is why archaeology digs happen before large construction projects. But the area around Stonehenge is very specific and very precious, and that's why UNESCO consider it a World Heritage Site. So there is a sort of boundary around that area where within which putting these huge tunnel portals would be much worse than putting it outside them. I mean, there's still potentially archaeology further to the east and further to the west than Stonehenge, but it's not part of that complex which is considered of global importance.
So the portals that you're talking about, if those are just dug outside the World Heritage Site and then the tunnel itself is dug deep enough to avoid most likely archaeology, what's the problem?
Essentially, that's what most campaigning organisations have come down to. They would like to see a longer tunnel. Of course, there are people who are opposed generally to road building and actually would prefer, you know, a general reduction in cars. But that's a separate point. In terms of the protection of the World Heritage Site, the people who took the case to the High Court recently would be largely content with a longer tunnel, as would lots of other bodies. The big heritage organisations like English Heritage, National Trust, Historic England have supported the current tunnel plan in a bit of a, this is probably the best we're ever going to get position, rather than that they're really massively in favour of a tunnel portal coming up within the site.
So just to sum it up, nobody wants the current situation, really. Some people want the shorter tunnel, although they appreciate it's not the best option.
Yeah.
Some campaigners want no tunnel at all. Other campaigners want a longer tunnel than all the existing heritage bodies have accepted, and they would kind of like no tunnel, but in the absence of no tunnel, what they want is a really, really long tunnel.
Yes.
Right. So this is a very weird and chaotic situation, but there has been a new ruling, which is, I guess, why you're writing about it in the magazine now, because of the High Court. They have made a judgment on it.
Yes, and the High Court said principally that the government and the Highways England haven't given enough thought to building a longer tunnel. They looked at very briefly looked at the option for the lunga tunnel, went, that's too expensive, let's not do that. And what the High Court is saying is you needed to give that more consideration. So for now, the permission to start work on building the tunnel has been quashed.
Permission to start work on any tunnel has been quashed?
Yes.
But what about the shorter tunnel option that is also not ideal? That's also been ruled out?
For now, all permission to start work is quashed. Now, they're certainly going to be appealing it. And what Highways England has said is that they are carrying on with the non-physical diggy bits of sort of organising contractors and that kind of thing to do the work, because they think they will eventually win on appeal to do something. Now, it is possible that they'll win on appeal to do the short tunnel that comes up in the World Heritage Site, or it is possible that they'll have to go for the longer tunnel. But in the meantime, they're not going to stop the organising side of things, so that the project slips back by more years.
If you had to put money on one of these things eventually happening, what do you think is the least unlikely option of this chaotic soup?
I strongly suspect we'll end up with the long tunnel.
Really?
Insofar as it's not uncommon for massive infrastructure projects to go massively over budget. So
that's a very polite way of saying it happens every single time.
military purchase, railway development, all of those things. At this point, they kind of know early what their big risk is, which is that they're going to have to build it longer to get out of the problem where the courts won't let them build what they want to. And you know, when UNESCO are already taking away British World Heritage Site ratings such as Liverpool, we don't want to lose the one for Stonehenge.
I mean, in an ideal world, I guess you'd repatriate it to Wales.
Yes.
Jane McKenzie there, and we will be bringing you the latest on the Stonehenge story as it evolves over the next 5,000 years. That's it for this edition of Page 94. We'll be back, hopefully within the next 5,000 years, with another episode. And until then, all that remains to say is, as ever, thank you to our producer, Matt Hill, and that the magazine, Private Eye, is available in all good newsstands. But why trouble your newsagent when you can get a subscription? That's the message from us, as it is every month. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.